Nick, I'm going to have to interrupt you because I've just realised the time. Nick, honestly, Jenny, nobody can do better than your husband in the bath in the middle of the afternoon comes running in saying you've got to go on the radio to tell people you rescue hedgehogs in Froom. Jenny, the certificate and the rosette are yours. Thank you for listening today. Stay tuned. Drives next with Tony and Holly.
The voice of the UK.
This is Five Live Drive.
Good afternoon. Let's get your BBC News headlines first. And the Israeli military says it has hit more than 280 Hezbollah targets in Lebanon. Hezbollah, which has been prescribed as a terrorist organisation by the UK, has been firing rockets into northern Israel. Lebanon's health minister says 51 people have been killed and hundreds wounded. Eva Homsi is a humanitarian aid worker in southern Lebanon, and she says the situation there is getting worse.
The suppliers are not reaching the area since 22 of September. No medications, no food support. People don't have jobs, they don't have resources, they don't have money. So they don't have money in their hands to be able to reach the goods and the services.
Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky has warned that Russia is planning a serious escalation of war against his country. He was addressing delegates at the United Nations General Assembly in New York.
Now Putin does seem to be planning attacks on our nuclear power plants, aiming to disconnect the plants from the power grid with the help of satellites of other countries. Russia is getting images of our nuclear power plants. Any missile or drone strike, any critical incident in the energy system could lead to a nuclear disaster.
Members of the RMT union have voted overwhelmingly to accept pay offers from train companies and Network Rail. The RMT says the result means its long-running dispute over pay and working conditions is over. Delegates at the Labour Party conference have backed a motion from the Unite Union calling for the government to reverse its cut to the winter fuel allowance. The vote is non-binding. Our political correspondent, Alex Forsyth, is at the conference centre in Liverpool.
Throughout the conference, ministers have been asked about this. They've addressed it head on, and there is certainly no sign that they're budging. But that vote does send an important signal to government about the mood of this party conference. A very clear message that they don't agree with that position on the winter fuel cut.
Crimes including shoplifting and fraud have cost the cooperative group almost £40 million in the first 6 months of the year. That figure is an increase of 19% on 2023. And the cost of unleaded petrol has dropped to its lowest level for 3 years. The average price per litre at more than 400,000 forecourts yesterday was 135.7 pence. Exactly. And Shoji Osaka has all the sport for us today.
Thank you, Holly. Good afternoon. AFC Wimbledon say they are forced to postpone their League Two home fixture against Accrington Stanley this Saturday as they've not been able to find a viable venue to host the match. Wimbledon can't play at their own ground after flooding damaged the pitch earlier this week. A crowdfunding page to help with the repair work has now gathered more than £100,000 in donations. Manchester City have confirmed that Rodri has suffered a knee ligament injury following their Premier League match against Arsenal on Sunday and will be out for a long time. The midfielder has travelled to Spain to see a specialist following initial tests in Manchester. And England's netballers are still left without that elusive series win against Australia in Australia. The Roses lost their three-match series to the world champions after being beaten in the decider in Victoria. They will now move on to New Zealand to play them in Auckland.
In the latest travel news, on the roads in Lincolnshire, the A52, Sleaford Road, both directions there are blocked because of a level crossing failure. This is between West Street and Lister Way, making it really slow before the West End roundabout. If you're coming inbound as well, very busy on the Slipsby Road and the town centre, looking pretty chocker because of that, so allow yourself plenty of extra time. Newport, the M4 westbound, one lane is closed between junction 25 and 25A. There's been an accident there, really long delays back to Mega Services at 23A. And in Bedfordshire, the A421, both directions there are closed because of flooding between the A6 at the Branston Way and the M1 around junction 13. That's the Bedford turning. So expect delays on those surrounding routes. Ellie Brennan, 5 Live Travel.
Cheers, Ellie. Thank you very much. Hello, everyone. It's Drive on 5 Live. Holly's with me again today. Hello, Holly.
Hello, I came back for another one.
Yes, glutton for punishment. And two more. Is it two? Yes, only Wednesday.
I'll be your counting down and everything. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Two more of
them. Two more. plus 2 hours and 56 minutes to go. That's all. Loads to get through on the show today. Of course, we're going to return to the situation in the Middle East at the moment. Difficult to predict what's going to happen next. In this afternoon, the Israeli army, or certainly one commander, has told his troops, you can hear the jets overhead. We've been striking all day. This is both to prepare the ground for your possible entry into Lebanon, while continuing to degrade Hezbollah as well. So there could be a serious shift in that situation this afternoon. We'll keep you across that.
Yeah, and of course, we will be speaking to a couple of UK citizens who are trapped out there in Lebanon as well, of course, after the Prime Minister has been urging the UK residents to leave as soon as possible. But what is happening to those who can't? We'll also get the latest on those accusations against Mohammed Al-Fayed and Harrods. We'll be speaking to our correspondent, Ellie Rice, in just a few minutes' time. And getting reaction to that incredible interview, if you saw it on BBC Breakfast this morning, with some of the survivors involved in this case. Really compelling stuff.
Yeah, we'll be hearing from Keir Starmer, hopefully live on the programme. You might have heard his interview with Rachel on Breakfast this morning. Well, he's going to be speaking at the UN this afternoon in New York, so hopefully that's going to be in our time. We think, if you want to make a note in your diary, around 5 o'clock. So we'll bring you that as and when it's time. I've been doing this show 10 years, and suddenly you do a story that you've never quite done before. And we've got an extraordinary story today. It's the story of Roland Cherry, who went on holiday to Africa and was practically almost eaten by a hippopotamus. He survived. They've got an incredible track record of sadly killing many, many people a year, 500 or so. Roland survived to tell the tale.
No one has ever survived. It's amazing. A hippo attack.
So, is that true?
Yeah, no one.
Well, there is one now. That's Roland Cherry, and he's coming on the show. So that's an incredible story. And while we're at it, Holly, just you know, in this show we have very serious things, and then we've got other things to deal with on the agenda. I was upbraided at my gym today because I did promise to say hello to Kathy and Pam, who listened to the show, and it's Kathy, I want to say, who listens to us in the bath between four and five, she said. So
Kathy's in the bath listening to us.
I just wanted to make
right
that
now.
Bath a little bit happier for Kathy.
Oh, well, there you go.
She's listening to us.
That's
now.
What we aim to do that.
So, hello. I've got it. I've done that.
Happy okay? in the bath.
Done my duty. So
let us know where you're listening today.
Well, if you'd like to. A lot of people listen to us in the bath. We're very therapeutic.
At 4 o'clock? That's quite early for a bath, I think.
I have a bath any time. Do you have set bath time?
Well, I'd like to think you're not having a bath at 4 o'clock.
Not on a midweek day, but generally, in my leisure time, I can be prone to have a bath at any time I want. I just feel like the need. Don't have a set bath time. Anyway, they're close to telling us to get on through the window.
But the bed's
if you want to add to that debate, feel free.
If you can
only bath at a certain time. 85058 or WhatsApp is 0885 909 693.
BBC Radio 5 Live.
The Checkered Flag Podcast. Keeping you up to date with everything Formula One.
It has been utter dominance for Lando Norris, who wins the Singapore Grand Prix.
It was an amazing race. A few too many close calls. I'm a bit out of breath, but very fun one.
Next up, Austin, Texas, and an intense 6-race sprint to the end of the year.
The Checkered Flag Podcast. Listen now on BBC Sounds.
The voice of the UK.
This is 5 Live Drive.
7 minutes past four on Drive Then with Tony and Holly. As mentioned, let's turn to the Middle East. The UN says 90,000 people have now been displaced in Lebanon since Monday. Israel's military says it's carrying out extensive strikes in southern Lebanon and the Bekaa area. The Lebanese health ministry says at least 53 people have died in today's attacks, and more than 220 have been injured. Earlier, Israel said it had intercepted a ballistic missile fired by Hezbollah towards Tel Aviv. It's the first time in this round of fighting that the groups targeted Israel's second biggest city. Let's get the latest from our correspondent in Beirut, Hugo Bachega. Hugo, hello to you. It's a swiftly moving story. We've kind of given the main headlines there. What else can you tell us about the situation at present?
Yeah, so we've seen that Israel has continued to carry out widespread airstrikes, as you say, targeting positions in the south, also in the east of the country. And we're seeing that the displacement of residents from the south continues. An estimated 200,000 people have been displaced, according to the International Organization for Migration. So a huge number of people now having had to flee their homes because because of this violence happening in the south. I was in a shelter yesterday here in Beirut, one of the many schools across the country that have been turned into shelters. And, you know, people described, you know, the intense airstrikes and that they had, you know, no time really to make preparations to leave. Many of them were carrying just some bags with some belongings. And many fear that they may never be able to go back home, because the concern here is that, you know, these airstrikes are part of the of an Israeli campaign that could include a possible ground invasion in southern Lebanon to try to of southern Lebanon to try to create a so-called buffer zone to push Hezbollah fighters away, to destroy Hezbollah's infrastructure in the south of the country.
Yeah, I don't know if you heard the very start of the show, Hugo. There's a piece on the BBC News website at the moment quoting an army chief called Herzi Alevi saying to troops today that, that this could be paving the way for a possible entry into southern Lebanon. Is there any indication of where we're going with this? Because on the one hand, Hugo, we're told Iran might be staying Hezbollah's hand at the moment. Where do you feel at the moment we're heading?
So, I mean, Hezbollah has been weakened, but it remains very powerful. As we saw today, it launched one missile, targeting Tel Aviv. The first time that Tel Aviv has been targeted by a Hezbollah missile. So I think there was a message here, and the message was that, yes, we've been weakened, but we're still capable of fighting back, of carrying out these attacks. They haven't yet deployed the most sophisticated weapons they have, including precision-guided missiles that can strike deep inside Israel. So, and the group has remained defiant. It says that these attacks are going to continue. They've tied themselves to the situation in Gaza. They say that these attacks are in solidarity with the Palestinians in Gaza, that these attacks are going to continue unless there is a ceasefire in Gaza. So this is Hezbollah's position. And on the Israeli side, what they're saying is that this is unacceptable and that they want to change the situation along the border to allow those around 60,000 Israeli residents who've been displaced from communities in the north. So, and that's the main goal of this campaign, they say. So it's very, very difficult to see how this is going to de-escalate. I think all signs are pointing to an escalation and a wider conflict between Israel and Hezbollah.
And Hugo, a very quick word, because we actually have a guest coming up to talk in detail about how it might happen. But what do we know about the potential evacuation of British citizens from Beirut at the from Lebanon at the moment?
So, yeah, so we've seen that the government is now sending 700 troops to Cyprus to prepare the prepare the possible evacuation of British nationals from Lebanon. And I think the message now, and this has been the message for quite some time, really, is that British nationals should leave Lebanon while commercial options remain available. We know that flights are booked up and they're very limited flights because most airlines have now suspended their flights from and into to Lebanon. So, you know, options are limited, but, you know, the airport is still functioning. And the problem with Lebanon is that there's just one commercial airport. So if the airport has to suspend its activities, people are stuck in the country because the only way to leave by land is through Syria, which is not really an option for most people. So very difficult situation. But again, the government urging British nationals now in Lebanon to leave the country immediately.
Hugo, thank you. That's Hugo Bachega there, our correspondent in Beirut.
Yeah, and as Hugo mentioned there, the government advice is for British nationals to leave Lebanon immediately. Hugo talking there about limited flights available. The Ministry of Defence is now sending 700 troops to nearby Cyprus to prepare for a possible evacuation. Now, Dan Harper is a journalist who lives in Beirut with his family. He is struggling to get a flight. I spoke to him shortly before we came on air.
Since the situation deteriorated, there was a clamour for flights, and everybody, you know, that could got a ticket and either has left or it will be leaving. I mean, there are Middle East airline flights, which is the national carrier, but we can't get on any. And now we're waiting to see if we can be evacuated. And I think that they'll only do that if it deteriorates further, which is, you know, by that time we'd like to be out.
Yeah, but what does that look like in terms of the situation deteriorating further? They're already urging people to leave right now, and you're waiting for an evacuation at this point.
Yeah, I mean, in hindsight, we should have left earlier, but they've been telling us to leave since last October. And if you keep hearing the same rhetoric, and, you know, you've got your lives here as we have and children in school, it's very difficult to just, you know, leave for an unknown amount of time because we've been living here many years. So we decided to stay, and we can now hear the sounds of the distant, you know, missiles landing and things. And it is a little scary for, especially for the children. We do have a plan to maybe move further north up the country towards Junye, where perhaps it'll be a little safer. And then if needed, you know, and they do evacuate via sea, we'll be closer to the port as well, where they would hopefully take us by ship, as they did in 2006, to Cyprus.
Dan, do you mind me asking, how old are your children?
My daughter is 9, my son's 11.
How are you explaining this to a 9 and 11-year-old right now?
He's a bit more aware of what's going on than she is because, you know, he's been at school earlier this week and they were talking about it and showing pictures and things. And he looks at the newspaper and I want him to be aware a bit of what's going on. And he's, you know, but not to the point where he feels too scared. And I've said, you know, we are far away from it. It is in the south in the country. They've always had these skirmishes between them. It's just a bit bigger than it was, you know, and the second that it becomes dangerous, we'll leave this area. But where we live, there's never been anything that's happened, but being close to it, you know, the closer it gets, the more scary it gets.
Yeah, and I appreciate, you know, you're trying to be strong for your children, but I mean, how do you feel right now? Are you concerned that it has become dangerous?
I'm trying not to panic, but at the same time, I do feel now a certain anxiety to go when possible, and I really wish the messaging was a bit more clear and up to date. You know, Keir Starmer keeps saying, you know, I urge you to leave now. All British nationals left there. Well, there's a lot of us, you know, that more than they expect because not everybody's registered, you know, that have lives here. Lebanon's a very multicultural country. I used to be on the radio here for many years and the main radio station was in English. You know, it gives you an idea of how multicultural people here are and how welcoming to foreigners they've always been. And I've been very comfortable here for many years. So I can imagine there's more people like me that are a bit worried about how they're going to get out, especially when they hear, you have to leave now, you have to leave now. Well, it's not that easy. There are no flights available for us to get onto. And I'm not going to go and buy a boat and start, you know, learning how to sail to Cyprus. I'm relying on the government to come and get us. And we'd just like to know when that will be.
Yeah,
and, and hopefully not too late.
What's the communication been like? I understand the British Embassy is still operating out of Beirut. Have you spoken to anybody? Do you feel they have control of the situation?
You can't get through to them. You get put through to a switchboard in London and they say we have nothing definitive to tell you yet, but just be ready, you know. So I'm also worried about my wife because she's Lebanese and, you know, will she be able to get on board the boat with us? You know, something I'd like to know. They shouldn't have this in place already. They should be telling us, yes, she'll be accepted. She's the mother of two British nationals. She's got a visa. No problem, but they can't even answer that question, you know. Pretty worrying for us not having answers that we need.
That's Dan Harper speaking to me a little bit before we came on air. He's a journalist who lives in Beirut with his family, obviously been urged by the UK government to get on a flight and come home, but says he can't get a flight, which is a difficult situation for him. We have urged him to keep in touch with us, though, so hopefully we will hear back and get an update.
Yeah, let's speak to Hamish de Bretton Gordon now, former British Army officer who's previously been involved in civilian evacuations at times like this. Hamish, hi to you.
Hi, good afternoon.
I think we got a sense there, hopefully you heard from Dan, a sense of the concern of people in Lebanon. What are the main considerations for the British authorities at times like this?
Well, first of all, I really appreciate, you know, the civilians, British citizens who are trapped there. It must be terrifying. I mean, there are lots of things to consider. I think, first of all, it's a good move to move British forces to Cyprus, which is, you know, very, very close to Beirut. We're very fortunate to have military bases there. What they will be trying to do is, first of all, as the Prime Minister said, get out if you can. Your previous caller is absolutely right. You know, it's one thing to say get out if you can, but you've really got to back it up with some detail. And I'm a bit disappointed to hear that they're not getting that detail from the embassy. But there are sort of three ways that the evacuation could happen. Ideally, it would happen with RAF transport aircraft flying into Beirut International and getting people straight out. And they could move a lot of people in a short space of time. But if that airport's denied, and one of the real challenges with these non-combatant evacuations is whether you're doing them hot or cold. Hot, what I'm sort of saying there is in contact, there's fighting going on. Cold, there's not. And people might sort of remember the evacuation from Sudan last year, which was over a much greater distance, but that had some of the same sort of issues.
But on that, Hamish, sorry to jump in, but on that then, what the government's going to have to make a choice at some point, isn't it? Because if the situation goes hot, as you call it, and there's a full-scale invasion, then the airport will be the first target for the Israelis. And so when does the government push the button?
Well, there'll be a whole lot of decision points. Now these plans are reviewed, you know, on a regular basis. And the plan for Lebanon, I'm sure, has been gone over with a fine tooth comb since the 7th of October last year. But yeah, you're absolutely right. I am not sure that the Israelis are going to take the airport. You know, their plans, is, if we just put them to one side, if things do go hot, then Britain would have to put troops on the ground to protect them. We won't be doing this in isolation. We'll be doing it with the Americans and the European countries who also have lots of civilians there. The sort of second option is to get people out on helicopters, Chinook helicopters. You know, they can only carry 40 or 50 people. But again, it's a short hop to Cyprus. And the third area, you may have heard, there are all Navy ships in the area, getting people, you know, from the beaches or the port,
right,
onto them. But if it's in contact, it is a completely different activity.
And on that then, Hamish, many people remember the evacuation of Afghanistan a few years ago and the scenes there. 10,000 UK citizens in Lebanon, if they all suddenly decide to leave, you say transport planes could get a lot of people out very quickly. How long might that take?
Well, I won't use a piece of string analogy, but if, 10,000 people on C-130 aircraft, you can, or C-17 rather, you can move a hell of a lot. The flight to Cyprus is only about 15, 20 minutes. So, you know, 10,000, you're looking at 200 or 300 each time. That is, you know, I don't know, 20 or so flights, which could, you know, I'm not a air mover, but you know, it strikes me you could do that in 24 to 48 hours. If you have to lift them in helicopters to somewhere or onto a ship, that'll take a lot longer. But yeah, I mean, the concern iterated by your previous interviewee is the fact if they don't already have the knowledge of what to do in the sequence of events, then that is something I hope the embassy are working very, very, you know, rapidly on at the moment.
Hamish, it's been good to talk to you. Thanks for your insight.
Pleasure.
Thank you. Hamish de Bretton Gordon there, former British Army officer, talking about the potential evacuation. As we've said, Keir Starmer's already advised people, British nationals in Lebanon, to leave immediately by any means possible. But if that becomes impossible, the military will have to step in. Right, it is Drive with Tony and Holly. It's 4:22.
Yeah, and as we were mentioning there, we are talking about thousands of people. Of course, after six, we will be talking to another person, this time a British student who's been trying to get out of Lebanon. And then just after five, Sir Keir Starmer will be making that speech at the United Nations Security Council. And as you might appreciate, these things tend to go this way and that way. So we hope after 5 o'clock, but that can be a little bit vague. So we will bring that to you as soon as we can.
Yeah, if you've been following the Labour Party conference today on Matt's show, you'll know that the unions have won a non-binding vote calling on Labour to scrap the cuts to winter fuel payments. Just after 4:30, we're going to speak to somebody who was kicked out of the Labour Party a couple of weeks ago in protest over the decision to remove the winter fuel payments from most pensioners. So Richard Bergen will join us shortly. And as I've already mentioned, you're going to get the first chance to hear an extraordinary interview we've done with someone who is trying to raise money for a tiny hospital in Zambia which saved his life after he was attacked by a hippo. Not many people, I can tell you this, have the same story to tell us as this gentleman. Have a little listen to this.
There was an almighty crash, much like a car crash, really, and our canoe leapt up in the air, and we were turfed out, and then I felt this thing come from underneath me and grab me, and then I was dragged underwater by the hippo in its jaws and taken down to the bottom of the river. The hippo came and grabbed me, in its jaws, reared out of the water, and then threw me like a rag doll, apparently 2 meters in the air.
Yeah, it's incredible stuff. You're going to hear that before 5 o'clock, an account that you won't hear pretty much anywhere else. That's Roland Cherry, who's going to join us on the show. Drive with Tony and Holly, 4:24.
BBC Radio 5 Live.
The voice of the UK.
We need somebody to look after our economy.
It's the biggest issue in Scotland at the moment.
Wherever you are in the UK, you're part of this with us on this network. 5 Live Drive.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
Now, one of the women who has accused Mohamed El-Fayed of abuse during her time working at Harrods has told the BBC that she and other women were like lambs to the slaughter. More than 20 women have now told the BBC that they were sexually assaulted by the billionaire who died last year. Now, 5 of the women have been sharing their story on live television on BBC Breakfast this morning. One of them, Catherine, was hired in 2005 to work in the department store.
And the first week or so was really humiliating because I had the Harrods attire of a black suit, and he would call me into his office and tell me this doesn't work and this is distracting, and then would rip my buttons open of the front of my shirt and stuff money into my pocket and tell me to go and buy more suits, and I would come back the next day and repeat it for a week. And then it was, your hair's awful, you need to straighten your hair. Sent me for a lip wax. So by the end of the first week, I was shattered, because this is supposed to be the big new job.
That was the first week?
Yeah. So I ended up with a lot of suits. That was my initial experience. I later travelled to Paris with him, realised I was in danger there because my door didn't lock and had to barricade the door with a suitcase and a chair. And ultimately, he forced himself upon me in his office. And I fought him off and I said, I'm a PA and I'm a PA only. That's all I do. And he said, well, you should have gone to work in the post office then if that's what you wanted. And the next day, my desk was gone and I lost my job.
That is the voice of Catherine. Well, Lindsay was another of the women who shared their stories with BBC Breakfast this morning. She spoke about the night she says she was drugged and subjected to an attempted rape during a work trip to Paris.
He always had tried to isolate me, and I was told that I was going on a business trip to Paris, when in fact it turned out I was being trafficked, because we went for dinner to the Ritz with another colleague and 3 celebrities, and I got a tap on the shoulder by the security, and me and this other colleague got taken to our accommodation, which I assumed would be the Ritz Hotel because he owned it and we were there. But we got taken to Dodie's flat, and as you walked in, all the doors locked behind you, and I said to the security guy, you know, what's that all about? And he said, oh, it's just to keep you safe, but it was to make sure you couldn't escape. So, that was my experience, and it was the most terrifying night of my life.
And we also heard from Nicole. Nicole worked for Mohamed El-Fayed as his executive assistant between 2005 and 2007.
One of the things I really vividly remember in the office was this palpable anxiety that you could really feel. It was like a sort of hum in the air. And people would explain it to me that he was very mercurial. So he would come in, and you would never know what you were going to get. You would never know if he was going to be in a good mood. He would be shouting. So every single day, you sort of have this anxiety of, right, what's the day going to bring? How am I going to have to manage this? How am I going to be able to get through the day? And it was a battle to sort of come out the other side smiling. And the awful thing is, I think you'd sort of get used to it.
Well, Gemma worked as one of Al-Fayed's PAs between 2007 and 2009. She told the programme about the lifelong trauma of being raped in Paris while she worked for the Harrods boss.
You know, it's something that's probably never going to go away. I think, you know, there's going to be ways we can start to deal with it, cope with it. But ultimately, you know, it feels like Harrods is never going to disappear. And it's something that's it's present in everyday life. You know, I think being able to come out and speak about it, although it's rehashing the trauma, it's helpful. You know, these women have been amazing support, and I think we're sort of getting stronger together day by day. But, I think it's definitely trauma that's lifelong.
And another woman, Jen, worked for Mohammed Al-Fayed for almost 5 years and was subjected to a number of serious sexual assaults and attempted rape. And this morning, she spoke about it publicly for the very first time.
Well, I think first and foremost, it's part of the healing process. I have lived with this as a secret that I've been deeply ashamed of for 35 years. I hadn't told a soul. And when this action began a couple of years ago, it offered me the opportunity to perhaps deal with that trauma and begin to heal from the trauma. Initially, I didn't want to be involved because Mohammed was still alive. And as ridiculous as that may sound to people not involved, he still felt like a threat until the moment he died. His death helped me to be able to come forward without fear of any consequences. I've recently been able to tell my family, which has been a huge thing for me. It was something I hoped never to have to do, but I have now. And I would like to be able to appeal to anybody else who's been through something like this that hasn't yet come forward. And I'm hoping that in doing what we're doing, we will encourage more people to do the same.
Our correspondent, Ellie Price, has been following the story, and Ellie was with the women earlier today. And look, Ellie, I think the most important thing to establish here, this has been, I mean, to relive all of this for these women and watching them talk so openly and candidly on live television, how are they? How are they coping with this?
Well, it's really brave, isn't it? And you listen to that testimony there that they shared with the world on television, as you say, under the lights in the studio. I think it was really striking. It felt like a real privilege, actually, to be part of that this morning. Five women who have appeared on that documentary. You heard Jen there waving her anonymity for the first time to talk about it. I think what was really striking was that the sense of solidarity they got from being together. I think there was a sort of strength in numbers feeling to it all, that they felt like they'd been isolated at the time. That was part of the strategy of Mohammed Al-Fayed, to make them feel alone. But actually, it turned out they weren't alone. And, you know, over the course, hideous, 1985 to 2010, all of these women were going through it. Now, there were five there today. We've heard dozens contacting the BBC since with very similar stories, often, talking about exactly what happened. And I think there's some strength, as I say, in numbers and an encouragement from these women actually to get their stories out there. So, yeah, it was incredibly brave to go through it, but incredibly triggering, of course, to have to go through it all again and to tell people.
I mean, if anyone watched the whole interview, and I would suggest that you do, all of them, bar none, they all said the same thing, that they all felt it was only them. That was part of the strategy, as you say. And also, it was the timescale of this. We mentioned, you know, as we read out all the stories of Catherine, of Lindsay, Nicole, Gemma, Jen, how many years this went on for. And that is what is so significant here.
I think that's absolutely right. Yeah, decades. And with that brings questions, doesn't it? So, I mean, of course, the big issue with all of this is Mohammed Al-Fayed is dead. He died last year, aged 94. That's how old he was, of course. You know, it gives you a sense of how in the later years all of this was going on. So in terms of the justice, well, obviously he can't be held to justice. He can't be held account. But I think there's a sense from the victims that there are others who can be held to account and justice can be served, because he didn't exist in a vacuum. There was a network of collusion or corruption going on. Now, another victim who wasn't on the programme this morning told me at the weekend that she felt there was employees within Harrods who were cherry picking young women to place them in the line of fire, if you like, of Mohammed Al-Fayed. It wasn't just Mohammed Al-Fayed spotting someone and liking them and inviting them in. Actually, other people were, in effect, to use her words, pimping younger women to sort of put them, usher them towards him. And from there on in, he could sort of groom them to do or not the things he wanted to do. And then you have this other issue of, once that assault and once that abuse had taken place, this idea that it was covered up or hushed up, that there were networks in place that when some of these women went to complain about inappropriate behaviour, they weren't listened to. And worse than that, they were essentially silenced and weren't able to tell anyone. And that's why, obviously, there were failed investigations from the police and the Crown Prosecution Service that never got anywhere during this time when Mohamed Al-Fayed was alive.
Yeah, and it's interesting because even by the very nature of some of the things that they've discussed, you know, the idea that a lot of this happened on trips away, you know, that they were tapped on the shoulder, taken from place to place. The very concept, even at its very core, of how many PAs Mohamed Al-Fayed had. And, you know, at one point, one of the women said that, you know, how many PAs does one man need? And nobody saw this as a red flag.
No, and why weren't more questions asked? I think that's exactly the point, is even if there was a suggestion that nobody, that the rumours weren't well known, then, of course, why were some of these more obvious questions not asked? I think probably worth mentioning, of course, Harrods is now run by a different company. It changed ownership in 2010 when Mohamed Al-Fayed sold out. And obviously, it's been run since then. So the new ownership, I mean, it's been under that ownership for 14 years, has said, of course, it's appalled by what happened, that it has sought to redress some of the wrongs that were done, that it has a compensation scheme available to current and previous employees. It's also told us that it's investigating whether any current employees within Harrods were involved in any of the allegations that have been made. But they haven't told us whether — that's an investigation, by the way, that's been going on since 2023. They haven't confirmed to us whether any action has been taken against any individuals, or indeed whether any individuals have been identified. And I think that's where some of the questions now lie with Harrods, you know, exactly what is going on and whether there are any — is there anybody working there now that was deeply involved?
Ellie Price, thank you for your time on this. And so it is worth watching back on the BBC iPlayer as well, some of those interviews. The time is 4:35. Let's get your BBC News headlines.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
Yes, those headlines this afternoon. The Prime Minister has urged Israel and Hezbollah to step back from the brink of an all-out war. Sir Keir Starmer's in New York for an emergency meeting of the United Nations Security Council. We are due to hear from him just after five. The UN says more than 90,000 people have now been displaced in Lebanon since Monday. Lebanese authorities say dozens of people have died in Israeli airstrikes so far today. Also at the UN in New York, Ukraine's President Zelensky said Ukraine would never accept a peace deal imposed on it by other countries. He also said he'd received what he called alarming intelligence that Moscow was planning attacks on Ukrainian nuclear power plants. And weather warnings have been issued for more heavy rain for tomorrow and into Friday. Two yellow Met Office warnings cover most of England and Wales. That is the news. Shojo's got the sport.
Thank you, Tony. The Tottenham captain Son Heung-min has expressed his love for his teammate Rodrigo Bentancur, despite the Uruguay midfielder making an alleged racist remark about the South Korean over the summer. The former Juventus player Bentancur was charged last week with an alleged misconduct breach by the FA in relation to a TV interview he did in June. Son says he's certainly not fallen out with his teammate.
I love him. I love him. We had a lot of good memories. We started play together when he joined, and he apologized straight afterwards. You know, when we had a holiday, I was at home, and I didn't even realize that was what's going on. And he just sent me a long text that you could feel that it was coming from his heart.
Well, tonight, the EFL Cup holders Liverpool host West Ham in the third round at Anfield. The West Ham boss Julen Lopetegui takes his side there. Under some pressure, West Ham lost to Chelsea 3-0 at home in the Premier League at the weekend.
We need to have all our strengths put in thinking about Liverpool to be able to compete with them and to beat them. It's not going to be easy task, but we have to think that it's possible and we are going to go. We are going to have the playing thinking that it's possible.
You can hear commentary of Liverpool versus West Ham in 5 Live Sport from 8. You'll have updates of Arsenal versus Bolton as well. Manchester United start the league phase of the Europa League with a home fixture against Twente this evening, the Dutch club where manager Erik ten Hag started out as a player. Ten Hag has added his voice to how the congested fixture schedule is likely to increase player injuries. Well, his fullback Nusair Mazraoui fully agrees.
For sure, a lot of players would be able to play up to 70 games every season. You see more and more injuries. So I think eventually that if you see this all together, that it's too much.
Well, one of the biggest names who spoke very candidly about the pressures of the increased fixture schedule was Rodri. Manchester City have confirmed today that Rodri will be out for an extended period. That's with a knee ligament injury. Meanwhile, in rugby union, the England women's head coach John Mitchell says his players don't deserve to play in front of non-crowds or low crowds. There are concerns about ticket sales for the WXV1 tournament in Vancouver. England face the United States on Sunday. And that is the latest from BBC Sport.
In the latest travel news, on the roads, the M8 westbound, you've got a lane closed between junction 27 at Paisley and 28 at Glasgow Airport. Broken down vehicle there. Cheshire, the M6 northbound, one lane is closed between 17 and 18 around Middlewich. You've got congestion just after junction 16. There is another broken down vehicle. And Newport, the M4 westbound, one lane is closed because of an accident between junction 25 and 25A. You've got congestion back to the Maygle services. Ellie Brennan, 5 Live Travel.
You've probably got a list of things your child needs for uni. Pans, cutlery, sheets, duvet, towels, you know. Well, this is a little reminder that they'll also need a TV licence to be covered to watch all the TV channels, live TV on streaming services and BBC iPlayer. On the downside, it's one more thing on your list. On the upside, you can continue to enjoy your favourite shows together on the family group chat. And they won't be bringing it home to be washed either. To find out more, search TV licence uni.
The voice of the UK.
This is 5 Live Drive.
Good afternoon. It's 20 to 5. You're listening to Tony and Holly here with you on Drive until 7 o'clock. And do stay with us. We have a great, great interview coming up with a man who survived a hippo attack. It's not very often I get to say that on the radio. Stay with us. And that's coming up in about 10 minutes' time. But before that, Labour members at the party's conference in Liverpool have backed a union motion calling for the government to reverse its decision to axe some winter fuel payments. Now, this policy will affect around 10 million pensioners in England and Wales, and ministers have defended the decision, saying the Conservatives left a £22 billion black hole in the public finances. The Unite Union boss, Sharon Graham, called the cuts a noose around our necks.
People simply do not understand. I do not understand how our new Labour government can cut the winter fuel allowance for pensioners and leave the super rich untouched. This is not what people voted for. It's the wrong decision and it needs to be reversed. Friends, we are the sixth richest economy in the world. We have the money. Britain needs investment, not austerity mark two.
That was the Unite Union boss, Sharon Graham, there. And Richard Bergen is the MP for Leeds East. He had the Labour whip suspended, along with six other MPs in July, for voting against plans to scrap the two-child benefit cap. Good afternoon, Richard.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. How was the conference?
It was very good. Just one quick thing. The votes on the two-child cap. I voted to lift the cap on the two-child cap.
Yes.
So the conference has been really interesting, really busy. And of course, as you say, there's been this really significant vote today on the winter fuel payments.
Was it significant? How?
I think it was very significant because the Labour Party conference has now voted that our new Labour government should scrap the cuts to the winter fuel payment. And that comes after pensioners and the wider public across the country have made their feelings known. And also after Labour MPs in Parliament protested against this policy in different ways. I myself voted against the winter fuel payment cuts. A lot of other Labour MPs voted they abstained and they adopted what I would call an act of abstention. They said, as a matter of conscience, I'm not prepared to vote for this. And so they didn't vote. Others wrote letters to the leadership of the Labour Party. So you've got a situation now. The trade unions brought this motion to the Labour Party conference. And the Labour Party conference has approved it to say the government should drop its plan to cut the winter fuel payment and should think again. And I firmly believe that. I think our Labour government's made a fantastic start on so many things, on public ownership of the railways, extra workers' rights, extra tenants' rights, GB Energy, scrapping the Rwanda scheme, so much else. But on this, I believe they've got it wrong. And one of the reasons I believe they've got it wrong is because there's 1.6 million pensioners in this country already in poverty who will lose a winter fuel payment if the government doesn't think again. So as we approach the budget in months' time, I and others are urging the Prime Minister to listen to the party conference, listen to millions of pensioners and the wider public,
so,
and scrap this plan.
Well, Labour, obviously, they are insisting, as you well know, that the worst off will still get their winter fuel allowance. There has to be a cut-off somewhere.
Well, as I say, there's 1.6 million pensioners already living in poverty who are going to lose the winter fuel payment as a result of this policy. I believe that unless there's a reverse in this policy, pensioners already living in poverty, there will be pensioners already living in poverty who will die as a result of this policy. And that's why, as a matter of conscience, I voted against it. Now, of course, we inherited a toxic mess in the economy from the Conservatives. You know, the £22 billion black hole has been mentioned.
So with that in mind, which the UK government have said, which Labour are saying, you know, if you can't afford the winter fuel payments for everyone that you say you'd like to give it to, then what do you do? The government says there's no money.
Well, the government would save, it projects, £1.4 billion of the £22 billion by this winter fuel payment cut. Now, you could raise £25 billion in excess of the £22 billion black hole by having a wealth tax of 2% on the wealth of those with assets over £10 million. Or, to put it more simply, another way, we're talking about £1.4 billion here, which is a relatively small amount of money in terms of the amount of money a government deals with. The £1.4 billion could be dealt with very easily by just asking these energy companies who have done so very well in recent years when people have been struggling to cough up a bit extra. That could deal with that £1.4 billion. So I do hope that the Prime Minister realises there's nothing wrong in saying from time to time you get it wrong. Governments of all stripes get it wrong on occasions. And I think it would actually show strength to say, you know what, we've listened, we've thought again, we're on this particular policy, we've got it wrong and we're going to make a change.
Richard Bergen, the MP for Leeds East, thanks for your time on that. It is 5:15.
We always say on this show, you never know who's listening, but I doubt if I said, have you ever been attacked by a hippo, anyone would text the programme. However, and live to tell the tale. Certainly, they're famously among the most deadly mammals on Earth. They kill 500 people a year. Their attacks are almost always fatal. One person, though, who could have texted the show, if I hadn't already spoke to him, is Roland Cherry. 3 months ago, he just set off down the Zambezi River with his wife, Shirley, on a canoe safari. He told me what happened next.
So we were in a two-man kayak, and the guide's in the lead kayak behind us, and there were three kayaks behind. And the guide in the lead kayak turned around to my wife, Shirley, who was in the front of our canoe, and said, hippos to the right will keep to the left. So we thought, no problem, we'll follow you and we'll go to the left, which we duly did. But about a minute later, probably no longer, there was an almighty crash, much like a car crash, really. And our canoe leapt up in the air, so back first. And we were turfed out into the water. And we kind of knew immediately what had happened. But in the kind of the impact, the side of the canoe smashed into my right shoulder and the shoulder was dislocated as we were turfed into the water. So we both arrived in the water. Shirley followed the instruction, which was swim like crazy for the bank. I was unable to swim because I only had one arm, really. So I was trying to do my best with the one arm doggy paddle. But I was a bit of a sitting duck, really, not making a great deal of progress. And then I felt this thing come from underneath me and grab me. And I kind of knew, and my heart sank, what was happening. And then I was dragged underwater by the hippo in its jaws and taken down to the bottom of the river. And I remember thinking quite vividly that this really isn't the way I wanted to go. You know, there were still many things I wanted to do in life, and being so killed by a hippo in a river was not high on that agenda. And it took me down to the bottom of the river, and then it let me go, because the next thing I remember is that my life vest, and I had a good life vest on, done up properly, was taking me back up to the surface. And it's funny what you do, but I started counting the seconds, and I got to sort of 8, 9 and 10, and then I got to the surface and took a gulp of air. But I remember thinking, that's actually quite deep, isn't it?
What did it feel like? Because not many people have done this and survived. So what did it feel like to be in the jaws of a hippo?
I was aware I was being dragged down. I wasn't aware of acute pain or anything, or any sort of awareness. I just had this sensation of being dragged down underwater. And I thought I was probably going to drown at that stage. But I had no great sensation of these enormous fangs digging into me. And I wonder whether part of this is my mind and the trauma and the way the body and the brain copes with extreme trauma, where it helps blank certain things out to try and protect you.
So you're back on the surface then. Again, what was going through your mind? What was your next move?
And I was relieved to get to the surface, obviously, and took a huge gulp of air, but I'm afraid that wasn't the end of it. So this is all happening very fast, as you can imagine. The next thing that apparently happened, and I have no conscious memory of this, is that the hippo came and grabbed me in its jaws, reared out of the water, and then threw me like a rag doll, apparently 2 meters in the air, but it, towards the bank, which is what saved my bacon, really. Had it thrown me back towards the middle of the river, I think that would have been curtains. But I have no conscious memory of that. The next conscious memory I have is sitting in fairly shallow water, looking down at my legs. My right thigh was a right mess. There was bits of flesh sticking out of my shorts, and there was lots of blood on my left leg where there was another puncture wound. And on my left arm, there was a bite through the bicep, we now know, but a huge gash, a 9-inch gash on my lower abdomen. But that was hidden by the life vest at the time. And I remember thinking, I've really got to stay with it and stay conscious. And then I heard Shirley, my wife, calling my name behind and other friendly voices. And then friendly arms came out and reached me and dragged me back. And I remember thinking, I'm in real trouble here. This is not good. And then a little motorboat arrived from the camp, and I was bundled on board and then taken back to camp. We know that I was thrown through the air by a very graphic eyewitness account of a young Australian girl who was in two canoes back from us. And this was all happening in front of her. She rather had the box seats, and she graphically describes this hippo emerging from the water. And then she saw me lying prostrate in its jaws, looking very limp and lifeless. And she thought I was already dead. And indeed, the guide apparently called out saying, no, he's dead or something. And that's when she saw me being thrown like a rag doll. She said, I hesitate to use this analogy, but you've seen the footage of the great white sharks playing with the fur seals off Cape of Good Hope. Well, she said, well, that's what it was like. You were tossed through the air like a rag doll. But I wasn't conscious of that. So it does make me wonder whether I was kind of comatosed at that stage in a kind of brain protection shutdown mode or something. I don't know.
Well, the fear, and I guess the delayed pain and everything. Now take us through how your life was saved then, because this is extraordinary as well.
Well, they got me back to the camp, which to say was only about 100 metres back upstream in this little motorboat. And I was then unloaded and put across 3 seats in a minibus that belonged to the camp. And then they drove me the sort of 30, 35 minutes to the local town of Chirindu in Zambia. So that's right on the Zambezi. It's a border town, but on the Zambian side. They'd arranged apparently to meet the air ambulance company there, who were going to take me across the river into Zimbabwe, because that's where they were based. But there was no sign of them when we got to Chirindu. So the driver, I think it was, of the minibus said, and this is a key decision, as it turned out, said, they're not here. We must take him to the hospital. And the Ntembe Mission Hospital was just a kilometre up the road in Chirindu. And they took me there. And I have some fairly vague memories of happening. And my wife, Shirley, was sort of doing all the organising at this stage. But they took me in and they said, Mr. Cherry, you're in a very bad way. We are going to operate on you now. So they didn't say, give us your credit card details, give us your insurance details. They just said, look, as a fellow citizen of this planet, you're in a very bad way and we need to sort you out. So they took me into the next room. I hesitate to call it a theatre. And then they knocked me out and then they operated. So they opened up, cleaned all the wounds as best they could. And then they sewed them up in a fairly rough way, but enough for me to be transported. And that early intervention under that first general anaesthetic proved to be key, because we were then moved across into Zimbabwe later early that afternoon. But we were seeking authorization from the insurance company to have me air evacuated to Johannesburg. But that didn't come through till the following afternoon. So the accident was Tuesday morning. We're now talking early afternoon Tuesday, but it took till Wednesday early afternoon to get that authorization. And then the aircraft, I was then taken to an airstrip, and then the aircraft loaded me up and took me down to Johannesburg.
And I want to come back to that hospital, the first hospital you went to, because this is where the story becomes very uplifting. But just before that, just summarise for us what they said in Johannesburg about the extent of your injuries.
The immortal words of Dr. Venter, the plastic surgeon, later that afternoon when she came to see me, she said, Mr. Cherry, somebody upstairs doesn't think your time on this earth is over just yet. And I just stared at her and she said, well, put it this way, you weren't lucky once, you weren't lucky twice, you were lucky three times. She said, if any of those wounds in your right thigh, your left leg and your abdomen had been 4 or 5 mil deeper, you would have lost one or both of your legs. And if the wound had gone into your abdomen, into your gut, we probably couldn't have saved you. You probably either bled to death or the infection would have taken hold and we probably couldn't control that.
And they did they not find teeth marks on your bones?
They found scrape marks on both tibias. Yeah, the my right thigh, there's a very graphic, and it's not for family viewing, but there is a very graphic photograph taken by Dr. Venter in that first operation in Johannesburg, where she's got an instrument that's gone inside my thigh, and it's about 6 or 7 inches long, something like that, and that disappears inside my thigh, but up my thigh, and there are tusk scuff marks on both tibia. On the tibia, left and right.
It's fair to say we're very lucky to be talking to you today, yes. Without a shadow of a doubt. And ultimately, I'm coming back to that hospital and what you're doing. But I just now just reflect for me on what you went through. How did the surgeon said somebody up above was looking down? How do you reflect on the fact you are here today talking to me?
She went on to say, "You are a very lucky man, Mr. Cherry. You may not feel it right now, but I do feel enormously fortunate. I mean, you only have to Google hippo attacks on the internet, and it's including the BBC website, and it's full of gruesome stories of people much less fortunate than me. So I was enormously fortunate on two regards. One is the extent of my injuries, although gruesome to look at, there was no vital organ damage and no broken bones. But as Dr. Venter said, literally a millimetre either side, you know, where those scuff marks were, would have snapped your legs off. Just, yeah. You know, you'd be gone. So I'm very fortunate that the injuries weren't worse. And I'm also very fortunate with that very early intervention at the Zambian hospital.
You've talked about your fortune. Let's talk about the gratitude you feel then to that first hospital now, because you're raising money for them, aren't you? What are you planning? What are you hoping? What are you doing?
Well, we've got a Just Giving page, Just Giving Roland Cherry / Roland Cherry. You can find that. And people have been enormously generous so far. But we, you know, what I've termed the kindness of strangers, these people didn't demand money. They saw a fellow citizen in great trouble and just got on and sorted me out. They sewed me up and sent me off to the more advanced care that I got in South Africa. But that early intervention, you know, they gave me everything that they had. And I feel I need to repay. You can't just take in life. You have to give back. And I feel enormously passionate that anything that I can do and raise money to help them buy equipment, what they urgently need and what they need perhaps more than anything is a 4x4 ambulance. At the moment, this is a little mission hospital that has no ambulance. So they can't move. They can't collect patients. They can't move them around. That would be a vehicle that would be used 4 or 5 times a day, I guess. Enormous help in the community. So although we've got a £10,000 target on the Just Giving page at the moment, I'm hoping that with the media coverage that we're getting about the story, we can blow that to smithereens with the kindness of people here in the UK. And if we can, you know, if people can give, you know, just a few pounds, it makes a massive difference if lots of people do it.
Just repeat the name of the page for us then, people. If the
it's Just Giving and / Roland Cherry. Cherry, same as the fruit, then they'll find me.
Roland, real pleasure to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure.
Thanks
nice
a lot.
To speak to you.
Cheers.
All the best.
Bye bye. I put the phone on eventually. What a story.
That is a remarkable. In it's one of those things you don't think you'll ever be talking about, really. No. An attack by a hippo.
Predictably, though, people are texting in now about hippo attacks that have happened to people they know. The difference, for example, my friend in his speedboat was attacked by a hippo on the Zambezi near Chirundu. He and his son survived swimming to the bank. He said it was one of his nightmares, seeing the bow of his boat as it slipped below the surface. So that's how Roland's wife survived. She just swam away. That's what you're told to do. But he was in the jaws of the hippo.
Literally. It was the bit where they said that there was a tooth mark on his...
One thing I just must point out, I spoke to Roland because he got it all on his insurance and I said, blimey.
Where does that go on the insurance policy?
What clause in your insurance was that? And he said, and he did say in all whatever the phrase is, read the small print before you go on holiday, because he was covered for safari treks and all that.
So that actually is covered by insurance.
Must be covered.
We do a lot of kind of stories about things that are not covered by insurance, and I have to say the hippo attacks was the last thing.
So in the spirit of Roland, and go to his GoFundMe page if you want to help that hospital. In the spirit of Roland, I wonder out loud. What is the weirdest thing you've ever claimed for on your holiday insurance?
Keep it clean, people.
Yeah, new underwear is not included. It's got to be a bit weirder than that. So we'll start with a hippo attack. What's the weirdest thing you've ever claimed on your holiday insurance and been paid out as well? That'd be interesting.
I love this text, by the way. Someone's saying, amazing interview with Mr. Hippo Cherry, which I think we'll call him now. What an excellent outlook on life. Thank you for that, Andy.
Yes, thanks, Andy. Also, a text has come in. I've got an apology to make for yesterday. We'll do that the other side of the news and sport.
The voice of the UK.
This is Five Live Drive.
At 5 o'clock, let's get your BBC News headlines. Israeli troops have been told to prepare for a possible ground offensive to fight Hezbollah in Lebanon. Health officials say there were more than 50 people have been killed and hundreds injured in the latest Israeli airstrikes. Hezbollah, which is classed as a terrorist organisation by the UK, fired a ballistic missile towards Tel Aviv, though that was intercepted. The UN Commissioner for Refugees, Filippo Grandi, says people in Lebanon are fleeing in large numbers.
More than 10,000 people, and this is a very conservative estimate, have now crossed into Syria. So going from Lebanon, both Lebanese and Syrians, into Syria, in spite of the very fragile situation there. It gives a sense of the incredibly difficult choices that people have to make under these circumstances.
Ahead of a speech at the UN General Assembly in New York, Sir Keir Starmer has called on Israel and Hezbollah to step back from the brink of all-out war. The Prime Minister is advising British nationals to leave Lebanon immediately, but journalist Dan Harper, who is stuck in Beirut with his family, told Drive they can't get a flight.
I wish I could talk to him. I wish I could say, look, very nice of you to say that. And yes, if there were lots of different flights available, we would be getting on one of them. But they are fully booked and it's impossible now to get on a flight. We need your help and we need you to send a flight to Beirut and start picking up British nationals that want to leave.
Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky has used a speech at the UN General Assembly to warn that Russia was planning a serious escalation of its war against his country. He told delegates Vladimir Putin was planning to attack nuclear power plants in Ukraine. Members of the RMT union have voted overwhelmingly to accept pay offers from train companies and Network Rail. The RMT says the result means its long-running dispute over pay and working conditions is over. Labour Party members have voted to reverse the government's decision to remove the winter fuel allowance from most pensioners. The motion at the conference was brought by the Unite Union. Its head is Sharon Graham.
People simply...